Hello, and welcome to Language as Purpose. I'm Yurika Foster. In Japanese, Fosta Yurika desu. And I've found purpose in studying and using the Japanese language. So I'm talking with other folks who also have a passion for text or use their language skills in their daily work, helping others engage with the wider world. So take a listen and hear how my guests are helping us stay more open to what we don't know, and also how language highlights our human qualities, what makes us human in this technology-reliant world. Today, we're talking with Christopher Martin, who founded Classic Stage Company, CSC Repertory in New York, and was artistic director from 1967 to 1985, directing and enabling over 100 productions. He also worked as an actor in New York and regional theater, and in national and state theaters overseas. His chief role was as director, but he also worked as a musician, composer, set and lighting designer, and translator. In addition to translating plays from French, Spanish, Swedish, and German, Chris served for 20 years as an American delegate to the International Theater Institute World Congress. So I guess it's no wonder with this level of experience that you are also a writer of international crime novels. Thank you for joining us.
Well, that and a nickel will still only get you as far as Staten Island.
So for me, when I think of people and how they become interested in the arts, I usually think it happens in your younger years. And maybe it's because you've seen a performance, a parent takes you to a play, you read a book.
No, I was born in a trunk.
You were born in a trunk. And where was the trunk going? I heard in an off-Broadway historical project interview that your grandfather was involved overseas in ethnographic work, later became curator of the Brooklyn Museum. Your parents were actors, and your father kept all the classics at home around you. So
I don't know if he read them, but he had them.
That's a huge investment still. So would you say that you were influenced mostly by family to begin with?
Well, my parents were in radio.
Okay.
Primarily. Well, but they also did theater and later television. But when I was growing up, they were in radio. So I was with them all the time in the studios. So there was never any question that I was going to be an actor.
Wow. Okay. Did they nudge you towards it, or you just, it was expected?
No, they tried to keep me away from it.
And why was that?
Because it's a tough profession.
Well, at the time, or even later on, were you actively looking up to actor directors, especially in Shakespeare, John Gielgud or Laurence Olivier? Did you have these kind of people that you admired very much? Or
oh yeah, in 1954-55, Olivier's Richard III, the film, was shown on television.
Wow.
And at that point, I made up my mind that's what I wanted to do.
So
the heavy stuff.
The heavy stuff. And did you think to yourself then, I also want to be a director, or it was just acting at that point?
I hadn't really thought about being a director.
Oh, okay.
I'd seen a lot of plays beginning in the 1940s. I think that Cyrano had a big influence on me as a kid. I saw that a couple of times with Jose Ferrer, who was a friend of my father, so
that helps.
I got to watch him take the nose off after the performance.
That's amazing. Okay. On the other side of this, you are also a musician. So I was wondering what came first. Was it music? Did you have singing lessons at home? You know, did you see a music journey starting before the acting, or what do you think?
I knew about the acting. That's what I was wanted to do.
Okay.
And in 1956, I was in summer camp. And the
radio
was on.
And where was this? Where were you at this point?
In Cape Cod.
Okay.
It was a sailing camp.
Wow. I can't imagine you.
Activities. So I spent most of my time on the rifle range. So I became a sharpshooter.
Wow. Okay. But you knew.
I didn't do anything with that skill.
Okay.
But the music that I heard that the counselors had on all the time was very important for the birth of rock and roll.
Okay.
One song in particular, Honky Tonk.
Okay.
By Bill Doggett, an instrumental,
mm-hmm.
12-bar blues, got into my skin, and I couldn't stop thinking about that. And I got very, very interested in finding out about music. Now, I'd had some piano lessons.
Okay.
And I think I already played stand-up bass.
You taught yourself, or how did you do this?
No, I took piano lessons.
Okay.
All kids back then.
They're forced to take.
You know, the Great American Society, we took piano lessons.
Yeah.
And somebody asked me to play bass in the school orchestra, and I did that. So I learned to read the bass clef and play with the bow. And
that's still a lot. I mean, for
it's not a difficult instrument.
Okay,
you play it well, yes, but you know, just started out because you're just playing most of the time. But I got interested in the guitar because we had a guitar at home.
Okay, there we go.
I did teach myself to play guitar, and later I had some lessons in classical guitar. But I didn't keep him up.
Okay. So does that mean that any of this, the music, I'm guessing that helped you, right? Because Shakespeare, you've got the rhythm within the text. I mean, do you look at it that way?
I think there's a connection between the two. And the blues, which is what interested me more than anything else, was storytelling. So I could apply that to when I finally got around to doing Shakespeare, which was not until I was 20 or 21. But I started playing guitar at 13.
All right. So you're playing guitar.
And I could get a band together, but easier than put a theater company together growing up in the suburbs. So that's what I did.
You mean because the guys want to look cool and look like they can play guitar. It was much
You got four or five guys together and you can put a band, you rehearse in the garage and then you try to find a place that'll let you play.
But that also means you've already started gaining discipline, right? You've got to put a band together. You've got to rehearse. So, I mean, that's very necessary for something like Shakespeare. You've got these like building blocks. So it kind of works together.
At the same time, I was working in the theater as a technician and as an actor in high school. Not that that was that important. A lot of people did that. But I got into the music business because the manager of the band pulled us into a recording studio one day here in New York. And within 3 weeks, the record was on the charts and we were touring with Alan Freed.
Pretty good.
All right. But, you know, I had it. By the time I was out of high school, I'd had it with the music business.
Why?
Touring, it's miserable. It's a really miserable life.
Even at that young age, you were already saying, this is not great.
For me, yes. Being in a car all the time on tour, I wouldn't ride the bus. I don't like buses. So I would drive the band. And I got tired of, you know, just, we all got tired of each other.
Yeah, yeah.
We liked the music, but we never played enough of it. You know, if you're playing in a concert tour with, like, Alan Freed, you're going to play three or four numbers, and that's it.
I see.
You're not playing the whole evening.
Okay.
And that's what I wanted to do. And we opened for Cousin Brucey's first concerts ever, because he took over for Alan Freed. I did American Bandstand and every TV show and did it work for every disc jockey up and down the East Coast. Did we make any money? No.
No.
Nobody in rock and roll made any money in those days.
So I had heard that you were also, you went into drama school and then left.
Yeah, when I got out of high school in 1961, I spent the summer in L.A.
Okay.
As an intern with Ralph Nelson, who was in well-known film director at the time,
mm-hmm.
who was an old friend of the family.
Okay.
And was willing to let me hang out at the studio and take notes for him. And
sure.
We worked on two TV movies.
Okay.
And did all the pre-production work for the film version of Requiem for a Heavyweight.
Wow.
So I was working every day with Ralph Nelson and Rod Serling, who wrote the screenplay. And then we did a staged reading of the script to see how it went. It was very different from the original television script. And I don't know if it was my suggestion, but when they did ask me, the two of them, what I thought, which script was better, and I said the TV script was far better.
Now, why? Do you remember? Why to you was it better?
I just felt that the development of the story and the characters was much more focused in the the original television script. And the final film version was very close to, much closer to the television script than the script that I was a stage manager for.
Okay. So do you think on some level this started you thinking about?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Because I had never really thought about the sense of being a director or a writer or anything other than being an actor, because like everybody else who gets into the theater or into acting, that's what you see. You see actors. You don't realize there's a lot more that goes into
it. There's a whole team that takes care of everything. Yeah. I mean, in essence, if you're already starting to think about this, you didn't want to stay in LA though, and you didn't have a desire to go into film.
No,
you wanted to go into theater. What? So you came right back to New York.
Yeah. After doing some recording sessions there, because my manager had moved to L.A. And so he stuck me in recording studios at the same time. I'm ready now to go and study Shakespeare and learn to be a Shakespearean actor. So I went to school, and the teachers were terrible. And most of the kids, there were some very talented, but most of the kids were there because their parents could afford to pay for them.
Right.
Like most drama schools. And I was not really learning anything, and I just felt I was wasting my time, and my mind was empty. I craved literature and working on classic texts and whole plays, not just
scenes. But what does that mean, that the teachers were not actively helping the students work on classic texts?
Not really.
What were they? They just...
Well, contemporary texts, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there wasn't much classics around at that time. So there was no reason to train people for that. So I left the school.
Okay.
I didn't know what I was going to do, but I was looking around for another place to go to maybe learn what I really wanted to learn. And I walked into Manny's Music on 48th Street one day to get some new guitar strings, something like that. And Henry, who handled the guitar sales, said to me, "You looking for work?" And I thought, he wants me to be behind the counters. I said, "I don't know, maybe." Why? He said, "Oh, they're looking for a guitar player and singer over at the Metropole around the corner.
There we go.
So if you're interested, Shelley Horn, who's the leader of the band over there, he's a client of mine as well. Go over and tell him I sent you."
Right.
So I went over, talked to Shelley. 2 days later, I started working.
And so that afforded you more
I was making a living.
Or, yeah.
And I was still looking around for school and couldn't find one that I wanted to go to.
Okay.
So I spent about a year working at the Metropole. But I moved, after 2 weeks, I moved to the other band that was playing there, which is the best band in New York. A bunch of guys originally from Knoxville, Tennessee.
Okay.
So they were playing.
What was the band called? Or what?
Sorry?
What band was this?
The name of the band was Ronnie Speaks and the Elrods.
Okay.
Their drummer had already gone home, and there was a young 17-year-old kid from Jersey City who'd taken over the job. His name was Dino Danelli, who later was one of the founders of the Rascals. So he had a very good career in music.
Mm.
The best drummer still to this day that I've ever worked with. At 17, he was the best drummer in New York. Gene Krupa used to come to the club.
Wow.
Even when he wasn't working there, just to listen to him.
Yeah.
Dino was phenomenal. And he had a great keyboard player. And Ronnie was a terrific singer. And his guitar player was going home also. He got tired of being in New York. He didn't feel comfortable there anymore. So Ronnie heard me playing with the other band. He said, "You know any country music?" I said, "Yeah, actually quite a lot."
Okay.
And he said, "Well, why don't you sit in?" So I sat down. My first day in the job with the other band, I got offered a second job. Now, I never thought of myself as being a terrific guitar player, just a dedicated one. And there I had two jobs.
I mean, that's very lucky. I think most actors and musicians, you know, ideally, you want to be a working performer. You want to be able to work and bring an income. And
so I did that. And while I was there, I met a guy named Larry Vann, who played in another band that played opposite us.
Okay.
He played keyboards. And Larry's interest in music was the same as mine, rhythm and blues. And he was terrific. He had also had a hit record when he was in high school, a doo-wop record, which he still makes money off of.
It's the way to do it, right?
The Sopranos love that. So any movie about the mob likes his record. So he still gets royalties. They use it on the soundtrack.
And all this time while you were working, you were, I don't know how you were assessing drama schools, but you were searching. You were searching for something.
Well, I would go and interview and sit in on classes and try to see what to do. And there was Larry getting his master's degree in music composition at Manhattan School of Music and working as a musician. I said, I'm going to go to college.
Okay.
I think I have to do that. I hadn't planned to go to college. And one day I walked into NYU and said, what do you need to do to go to college? He said, your PSATs or your SATs. I didn't have them because I hadn't planned to go to college.
So you said, I'll take them.
So I took an adult examination and I got in.
Okay.
And my father was not too thrilled because NYU was expensive.
As it still is today.
I had to figure out some way I could stay there because any other option to go to college would mean leaving New York, and I was already set up in New York and making a good living as a musician.
Right. That's risky, yeah.
But by the time the first semester was over, I had a graduate teaching fellowship because no graduate student wanted it.
And this enabled you to learn all aspects, essentially,
This gave me $50 a week and no tuition, and I could take any classes I wanted.
Phenomenal.
So I immersed myself in film and literature.
So the film was an elective or film was part
film
of the—
Film is elective. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I was in the same class as Marty Scorsese.
Okay. And so how many years between this and founding CSC?
Well, 4 years at NYU, 2 degrees.
Okay. Okay.
Until I said, that's enough. I don't need to go for a PhD. Time to get out of here. And I took the company that I founded inside the university out with me.
Okay.
In 67, founded CSC.
Classic stage company.
Well, it was originally, we had the initials. We didn't know what it stood for. It was because the original, what everybody called the company, said, you're going to work with Chris's Shakespeare Company.
It works. I'm glad that worked out.
Well, we can't call it that publicly. We have to come up with something. So we decided on Classic Stage Company.
Okay.
But we dropped that name after two productions.
Why? What happened?
By the time we got to the third production, we were already in rep, which means we kept the productions and on different nights. We'd had different plays.
Okay.
Same company. And our general manager at the time, which a guy named Bill Snow, who was much, much older, suggested we call it CSC Repertory. So we could push the idea of repertory because nobody was doing repertory in New York at that time.
Okay. So for our audience who does not know what that word means.
Repertory means permanent company, permanent library of productions.
Okay. So this means a rotating?
Rotating. So you could see one play in the afternoon, another play in the evening. The tomorrow night, there'd be a different play. And we'd do as many as 6 different plays in 1 week.
Okay. And I imagine this does something for the actors, this kind of structure. This helps them become better actors.
Oh, and the interesting thing is that if you're still playing a production after a year or two, everything else you've done in the interim, the other 10 or 12 plays, feeds back into the ones you did originally, and they improve.
Right. Okay. Okay. And so how does it help actors perform as a team? Because you're always a team, right?
Well,
It's
like being in a baseball team or a football team.
Yeah.
You're working together all the time.
Yeah.
And you're using different skills in each production.
Okay. So,
you're a leading actor one night and a supporting actor the next night, maybe a walk-on in the third production.
Okay. So just so the audience knows, I have taken a class with you, and I've also, you know, been lucky enough to have you as a private coach for Shakespeare. But in class, I can remember we had Ibsen in front of us. I think it was Hedda Gabler. And you were saying, you know, just remember, it's a trinity, the playwright, the actor, and the audience. And I think a lot of, maybe not a lot, but there are enough actors who maybe don't see themselves as part of a team. And I always liked that thought of this trinity, like you're kind of in service of the story. And if I'm thinking about film, I'm always thinking, you know, you're in service of the story. It's not about you, right?
Well,
it's about what you're...
In film, you don't have the luxury of playing on a team. And sometimes you're playing scenes of people and you've got to stand in.
Right, but you're still working with other people on set to make sure everything is for that.
In the company.
Yeah, yeah.
You're doing full plays.
Yeah.
You're working together. You're dressing together in the dressing room every night. There is a real sense of community.
Do you remember seeing some actors who just couldn't or didn't want to work that way and they left because they didn't want to do that?
Everybody wanted to work that way, I think, because it was supposed to be the epitome of working in the theater.
Okay.
But it's not for everybody, because you do have to sublimate your ego.
Uh-huh.
If you're not playing the lead that night, don't give me any grief.
You should be able to stomach that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so what is it about a rep that makes it appeal to an audience the way CSC did? Because CSC was a very successful repertory.
Yeah. And the odd thing is we were successful with the long, difficult plays like Man and Superman, 4 hours, Moby Dick, 4 hours.
Yeah, I can't imagine today a critic maybe. I don't know how many would, but at the time, I mean, were people very surprised at this? You must have felt proud about it.
Yeah, because it was different from what other people were doing.
Okay.
And that was what made us unique. And so we filled that
void.
Niche in New York.
Yeah.
And what they felt was a special energy in the performances, because we all trusted each other. It's like, again, like a sports team or a great dance band, jazz band. We played off of each other. We all were in service of the play.
Sure.
And the audience.
Right, right.
So the Trinity was working all the time. And the audience got to see actors they began to like in different roles, and they could see as many as 6 different plays in 1 week.
So they kept coming back. They said, this is great.
They kept coming back. And those productions and for the theater company, those productions that were most successful, we played more frequently.
Okay.
And sometimes they went from what year to year. For instance, I played in The Homecoming by Pinter for 5 years. But not every night.
Okay. Okay.
But I played that role for 5 different seasons. Or plays would be out for a year or two and then they come back.
Mm. Okay. So what does it take to be the director of a repertory? Because I think that means you have to be equal parts risk taker, collaborator, decision maker. But especially in New York
and
at
roofer.
The time you were doing this, roofer.
Roofer, yes. Plumber, electrician.
But, I mean, so what is it about you? What made you gravitate towards that, to have that responsibility? I mean, because there are people who can't do that. That's just not, they don't.
Well, it's the same reason I became a band leader. I was much happier when I was the band leader, not a sideman.
Because you want to be in control?
Control. Because I saw what I thought was the right way to do something. And if I was playing with like that first band I played with, Ronnie Speaks in the Elrods, Ronnie had very good control of that. The music was terrific. The arrangements were wonderful. I didn't mind being a sideman. But I played with other bands where everything was disorganized. And
yeah.
I was always the one that pulled everything together.
But again, at the heart of it, I mean, it's not like you left your ego at the door. You could be a sideman or you could be the leader of the band. You understood that there was some communication that had to take place. This was not just going to fall together, right? You really had to work at it. So that's still something.
Discipline.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to start thinking about the overseas language part of your career. So you took a break, you went to Paris and Berlin, I think, on language grants. And then again, you worked many more times in the theater overseas. But can you tell me about what realizations you had working overseas about text in particular? You know, what were you thinking about the audience? For example, I remember you always saying that an audience thinks in ideas, not sentences. So how does that kind of apply overseas as you were?
Well, first of all, you're working in a foreign language. I didn't have a lot of foreign languages. I had some French and German by the time I started doing that, but I certainly didn't speak Turkish.
Very
or
hard
Korean
language.
Oh. Or Polish, or all the places that I worked. But you begin to be able to understand how the language is working on an audience. So I was working with national and state theaters, so I was working with very good actors.
Okay.
And sometimes difficult actors who were just clocking in to get their check, but certainly a lot of good actors. Okay. You had permanent jobs with these big state theaters. And you're working every day and you're hearing the language. Mm-hmm. And you begin to understand through the sound of a sentence, through the music of a sentence, whether it's being done right. And then working with the text, and in some cases, the text was translated into that language that we were working with.
Okay.
I could tell the translation wasn't right.
So how could you tell? I mean, you...
Sound. I think I told you the other day about when I was working on Grapes of Wrath in
Yes, please Turkey. Tell us this. Yes.
I came out of the... I was in the shower and I came out of in my hotel room, not on stage.
Great.
And I heard in the next room, on the TV was on, that the Big Easy with Dennis Quaid and Ned Beatty were talking to each other and said, wait a minute, how do I know that? It's speaking Turkish. It's dubbed. So I walked in and sure enough, that's exactly what it was. And I was sat there mesmerized listening to these two American actors speaking Turkish because that sounded like them.
Mm-hmm.
All the idiosyncrasies of the way they spoke.
Mannerisms even. Or, ones, yeah.
All there. So I asked the actors the next day through translation to the actors.
Okay.
Why this was possible or how this was possible. And they said, oh, we're very good at being at mimics. We can copy. We're very good at copying what people sound like. So we do a lot of dubbing.
Mm-hmm.
But we also work with a different language, of a different version of Turkish when we do that than what we do in the theater. And I said, what's that? Well, there was an official Turkish and there was an unofficial. I don't remember what the actual
official just means more formal.
It was a much more formal literary language.
Okay.
What they would write books in, but people don't speak like that on the street.
Sure.
So there was, so when they work in film, they're using that everyday speech from the street, and it's more flexible. So they can work in phrases. They don't always have to have complete sentences.
Okay.
So the translation that had been done of The Grapes of Wrath was my adaptation, but had been translated into Turkish, had been done in a literary manner. And Steinbeck, the original, the author, the novelist, does not write in a very, he's a very literate guy,
mm-hmm.
but he doesn't write in formal language. He writes in something that's very easy to connect to. There's no distance between him and his reader. So we took a week of rehearsals and just retranslated the play. I would read the line in English the way it should sound.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the words in English and the structure in English, but the way it should sound.
Okay. And you had interpreters there with you?
I had two interpreters.
Okay.
And then collectively, we found a way to say it in Turkish, which would mimic that.
And what did the actors think? Were they sitting there just sort of reveling in this experiment, or?
I think most of them. There were a few that were just, why can't we just get on with it? But most of them understood the difference because they could feel the difference. All of a sudden, they understood the play better.
Mm, God, that must have felt great.
But it's the same thing when you go to see a Shakespeare play and you can tell that somehow the actors are not used to doing Shakespeare and it sounds phony.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Shakespeare is phony. They sound phony because they're not in tune with the kind of music that Shakespeare
rhythm,
is.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with musicians. You tell somebody sounds wooden or they sound inept, that they can't swing. Or in simpler terms, the blues, which is very much like Shakespeare.
Oh, please. Okay. Expound.
Blues is in 4-4 most of the time. Shakespeare is in 5-4. But there's a definite rhythm to Shakespeare's lines and a definite rhythm in blues and a definite form in the blues, usually 12 bar. There are other variations, but the standard blues is 12 bar.
Mm-hmm.
Three chords in a 12 bar pattern. And the blues developed out of the slaves working in the cotton fields, and they would sing while they worked. And the leader would sing a phrase, and the group would repeat it. Then they would add. So it's call and response, called.
Yep.
And it was created by the group, the music. So Shakespeare, it's the same. We've got the guy who is the leader is Shakespeare himself.
Right.
Who's giving us what to do. And we have to find a way to make that come alive. If you work against the rhythm of Shakespeare, it's like working against the rhythm of the simple rhythm of rhythm and blues. It sounds like somebody fell over themselves. You have to. Even if you think blues is too simple, you have to You have to see it as a major form, or you play, jazz players don't usually like the blues because it's too simple for them. They want to play fancier chords. They want to play more chord changes. You do that, you're not playing the blues anymore. You have to keep it very simple because it's about storytelling. And it's not about misery. The key to playing the blues is I've been down so long that the bottom looks like up. So you're always at the bottom looking up, making jokes, saying, "It's not, why am I feeling so bad about the fact my wife left me?"
Yeah.
And you're singing about things that the audience that the songs were written for can identify with. Shakespeare was doing the same. He's writing plays perhaps about kings in the past or the Romans or whatever. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. He was writing up with characters that spoke like the audience was used to hearing speech about the situations that the audience themselves had already experienced. So they could laugh, they could cry, they could be excited, they could be afraid based on what Shakespeare was giving them, because they could identify with it. It was not a highfalutin form of entertainment. It was popular theater. In France, there's a movement called Théâtre National Populaire. It's theater for the masses.
Mm.
It doesn't mean anything being played down to them. One of my mentors, Roger Planchon, ran the Théâtre National Populaire for years, and he had a 900-seat theater.
Okay.
In a suburb of Lyon, no numbers on the seats. So you bought a ticket and you went in, you found
you
a
just
seat.
Found a seat.
The whole experience was one of, this is for everybody.
Yeah.
You might be sitting next to a very rich guy. The president of France might be sitting on the other side of you for that performance.
Mm.
You never know who you were going to be sitting next to. That is, I think, a very important kind of theater. And you weren't segregating the audience based on how much money they paid for seats. Everybody paid the same price.
Right.
And I ran my theater the same way. It made rich people angry because
mm-hmm.
they wanted reserved seats. They wanted the best seats in the house. They paid the same price. Get there early then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even the critics, I didn't save seats for them.
That's pretty good. So would you say that if you were giving advice to somebody who wanted to be a director, would you say it's really important to have some time overseas to see the difference or to see how people direct? Or
I think it depends on where people come from wanting to go into the theater, what they think the theater is.
Mm.
If they've only been to Broadway, they don't know anything about theater. Broadway's a marketplace. It's not a place where anything's created. There was a time, but no more. It's been a long time. That was already gone by the time I was in drama school in the early 60s.
Mm.
It's things are usually developed somewhere else and come to Broadway. And it's controlled by the market, by money. What does a Broadway ticket cost now? I don't know.
The prices are too high.
It's ridiculous.
It's too high.
I felt we had to sell our tickets for competitive with movie theaters.
Well, that's a good structure.
So we had to find funding to make up the difference. But I know that my theater nowadays
mm-hmm.
charges at least $100 for yeah. some of the things they do. It's ridiculous.
So,
because you're limiting, you're then saying you're going to only play for people who can afford to pay that price.
Right, right. So that's, you know, it's so important to keep things open to everybody. To think about this in a different way, but today I think there are many things happening across the country in the U.S. here that are a little alarming. There are more libraries whose budgets are being slashed. They can't stay open 7 days a week. There are books being banned, which is more of a content issue because people are fighting over, you know, the content of what a child should be seeing, although a lot of the banned books are considered classics. And then we also have language programs being eliminated from universities. And this is not just rural universities. This is just speaking broadly. But so when you have text decreasing or budgets for these areas where people can find text being eliminated or slashed, I mean, what does that do to what makes us human? Like, why is it important to be reading the classics? Why is it important to read about other countries?
Because the past is prologue. It's that simple. There's nothing new under the sun. Reading Victor Hugo or Charles Dickens or Shakespeare or Marlowe, Sophocles, it's all the same. Life hasn't changed that much. Certain moments in life are different. Certain things tangibly, we live a little bit differently, but we are the same people.
Mm.
We haven't changed that much. People are people.
Yeah.
And so Shakespeare still speaks to us. Chekhov still speaks to us.
Right.
The problem with young people is they're not exposed to this kind of theater. They know theater as Wicked.
Right, or Broadway, essentially. Yeah, yeah.
Wicked, I have to say it. In 60 years of theater going, Wicked is the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. It's the most insulting, incompetent production I have ever seen. Yet, it is popular with 12-year-old girls. They love it. Fine, that's okay. And their parents are willing to spend $200, $300 for their tickets so they can see it. But if that's what they think theater is, I feel sorry for them.
So what do you think theater, the real definition, according to you, is or what it should be? What is it supposed to do?
When you go back to the Trinity.
Yeah. Well, that was you. I took it down as a note in class. So it was said.
You have the author has something he wants to say to the audience, or she wants to say to the audience.
Yeah.
How do they do that? They need actors. They need a theater company. They need a theater. So he passes his work to the theater company, who then interpret it for him with his intentions in mind.
Right.
So that he can reach his message, his characters, his story, the audience. And the audience fills in the blanks.
Right.
This is what's missing in so many productions. You go to Broadway, they spend a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
The audience doesn't have to do anything but sit back and marvel at all the money that was spent. They're not using their imagination. They're not listening. You have to listen in Shakespeare to know what's going on, or Chekhov, any more complex.
So
what we think of as a more complicated playwright.
Right. And in essence, you could say Shakespeare is kind of the ultimate in helping us look at what makes us human.
Think when we talk of horses that you see them printing their proud hoofs in the receiving earth. For 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our kings, carry them here and there, jumping o'er times, turning the accomplishments of many years into an hourglass. He says it right there. We need your imagination to make this work. We can't do it on the we can't fill this arena with the two mighty armies, and we can't show you the Battle of Agincourt. We only have 10, 12 actors.
Right.
You're going to have to piece out our imperfections with your thoughts.
And that's sort of what makes it so, I guess, appealing to the audience. Like, it's rapt attention. I mean, you're forced to really pay attention if it's done correctly.
Well, the Greek theater operated the same way. The audience had to pay attention and listen.
Mm.
And the form of the Greek theater, the amphitheater, had the audience looking down onto the stage.
Right, right.
So they had to sort of sit forward. So it forced them to lean in and connect.
There was excitement. There was extra.
Broadway theaters, the proscenium arch is the death of the theater. They should destroy every one of the theaters on Broadway, and the world would be a better place. The audience is sitting in a hole, looking up at the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're sitting in the front row, you're looking at the actor's shoes, not their faces, because you're sitting in a hole. And the people who spent the most money sit the closest. The people who are the most interested to be there
are sitting
in the balcony and they can't hear anything.
Yeah.
This is not good. And in a Greek theater, if you sit in the back row on the side, you can hear a pin drop. You can hear a whisper. Why is it we can't do anything with acoustics in theater now? This was a time before computers.
Right.
Outdoors. And you can hear everything.
So today we also have computers now, I don't want to say taking over, but with the pace of generative AI and technology moving very fast, there are film studios that, you know, are using AI, starting to use AI for scripts. Writers, you know, have a much more difficult time. And so a lot of people, if they consider learning a language, someone else will say to them, that's not necessary. You just take your phone to France and look up what you need to say on the spot. You know, what What is the advantage of learning language? What would you say to somebody who said, I don't need to think about text?
I don't know
text.
If there is an advantage anymore. For me, it's because I wanted to understand better the field I was working in.
Right.
I grew up with radio. This is one of the things that's missing now in our life. Radio, where you had to fill in the blanks because all you heard was actors talking.
And it took a lot of effort, right? I mean, the sounds, you had to have people making sounds. Everybody had to come together to do a broadcast.
You'd be surprised how fast they threw those. Because I grew up in the radio studios in Rockefeller Center. My father would walk, or my mother, they would walk in the studio. They'd be handed a script. They'd do it once. They read through it once. And then sit down at the table for 20 minutes, and the director would make a few cuts or give them a few directions, and then they go up and do the show.
But maybe that's also because there was more human-to-human connection. They were in that. They were, you know, there wasn't this kind of, I don't know.
It was a skill, like being a studio musician. You have to be very good at your craft to be a studio musician. You go in there and you have to deliver on the spot. You can't say, I'll work on it. There's no time to work on it. We're recording.
Right.
The tape is running. Let's do it now.
And you can't depend on a machine. Even in Shakespeare, I remember, somebody might take out their phones, right? If you ask them what the definition of something was, and they would take out their phone, or they would, you know, look at Shakespeare on a tablet or something, and you would say, where's the book? Did you get the book? How about, you know?
Well, it depends on how you're raised and the world you live in. In my day, which is a long time ago, we worked with books because we didn't have tablets and computers.
Right.
We didn't even have television yet.
Right.
So the book was important. You held it in your hand. Mm. You took good care of it so it wouldn't fall apart. And my father had this big library of all the great works. Now, I'm not talking about theater. I'm talking about literature.
Right.
And I read all this stuff because it was there. And so books as an entity meant something to me.
Mm-hmm.
I could take down Moby Dick and look at it, just the outside of the book, and my memory would bring back everything that was in the book.
But you were also forced to imagine. If you have a computer, it spits something back at you in 1 second. You know, there's no...
It's like music. In music, we had records, and you had a record jacket. You read about the record. You handled the record. You made sure
you had the liners,
didn't scratch it.
Yeah. I mean,
you had more human contact. Now it's not like that. Everything's on Spotify, you know, and you can download anything you want. I remember when the iPod came out, and a friend of mine said, I have 20,000 songs on here. I said, you don't know 20,000. You're not even going to listen to most of those. But I can.
Yeah.
I said, but you won't.
Right.
We had record collections because there's things we really cared about. And so we liked a particular band or singer, and we'd buy an album, and there'd be all kinds of music on there that we didn't know about, and we'd know which songs we liked and which we didn't. And you had to be patient. If you put the record on, you had to wait 20 minutes before you could turn it over to hear the rest of what was going on.
So what about people who are thinking about learning about Shakespeare? Maybe it's an actor who's a little older and they already have a film career, you know, and they say, oh, it's going to just take too much time. Or maybe it's a younger person who says, I'm afraid of it.
It doesn't take time. And yes, they say they're afraid or they think it's too difficult. It isn't. It's the simplest play. He's the simplest playwright in the world.
Mm.
He's written everything you need on the page.
It's all there.
It's all
there. Everything you need,
it's
right
all
there.
Absolutely there. Yeah, yeah. You just need to know a few shortcuts. I was teaching at a place one point and said, don't use that word shortcut. There are no shortcuts in the theater. I said, stop being pretentious. Yes, there are. Like shortcuts in music or anything else, there's certain techniques you need to know to open the way to you so that you can do it. First of all, you have to understand iambic pentameter. What's iambic? It just simply means it's like a key signature in music. You have to know key signatures in music if you're going to play. Even if you can't read music, you got to know it's a song in 4-4, is it 3-4 or 6-4 or 12-8. You know, you have to know that or you can't play it because you have to be able to count when you're playing. So Shakespeare, iambic pentameter is simple. Iambic means alternating stress. You have a strong stress every other beat, and you have five beats in the line. You have 10 syllables, 5 beats, sometimes 11, so you have an offbeat at the end, but you have 5 strong stresses in a line.
And as long as you know that basic...
You start with that, to be or not to be, that is the question. To be or not to be, that is the question. It tells you exactly what the rhythm is. And if you stick to the, and each line is like a measure in music. So you have to treat each line like you would a measure of music. And when you're learning, you isolate each line. Whether it is noble in the mind to suffer, for what? The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And what you do at the end of the line, you ask yourself a little question, which will lead you to the next line. Suffer what? The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Or to take arms against the tree of troubles. And then what? And by opposing, end them. It becomes very simple that you deal with each line separately. Most actors are taught in school about Shakespeare, keep speaking until you reach a period or a semicolon. It's nonsense. Shakespeare didn't write the punctuation.
And well, today it also helps, right, to think about how we would maybe say that that line in our heads.
We're
to
talking
help.
Now, we're talking off the top of our heads. We have an idea we want to express. Maybe it comes in a phrase, maybe it comes in a complete sentence.
Mm.
We're not thinking in complete sentences.
Right.
We're thinking in phrases or ideas. And so you have to, Shakespeare has to sound like that. And then it begins to sound like very good talk, but it's ordinary talk in terms of thought process. There's nothing complex in Shakespeare.
Okay, well.
It's really simple. But the key is 5 beats to the line. Take a breath at the end of the line while you think of what the next line is about.
Mm-hmm.
And don't worry about the punctuation because Shakespeare didn't write the punctuation. Modern editors have put that in. So you can look at it that it's in a complete sentence. It's grammatically correct. The grammar in Shakespeare's time didn't exist. And every playwright had his own sense of grammar.
That's true. That seems like a pretty good basic piece of instruction to take away. Is there anything else you think that we can do to kind of maintain some more respect or attention to text?
I think all of us have to be confronted with it.
Confront.
We can't start from zero. We do anything we do in life, we do it. It's like learning to speak in the first place. When we're children, we look at what's around us and we learn to speak because we listen to our parents or our uncles and other children. And that's how we learn. It's not learning a language. You don't learn a language by sitting in a classroom.
Right.
You have to work with it. So when I was studying languages, I was very bad at languages.
That's surprising.
No, because I'm deaf.
That's even more surprising.
I'm legally deaf.
I don't know how you've done all that you do.
So it makes it very difficult for me. I read lips. So when you hide your face, your mouth behind the microphone, I'm having trouble.
Sorry.
I have a strange deafness. I only hear vowels. I don't hear consonants.
So how did you overcome that? How did you work around that?
Because I was already an actor and I was already a musician before I was diagnosed. So I didn't know any better. I'd have found another way to do it.
Right. You would have found another way. Exactly.
But I did find another way.
Yeah.
But if I'd been told that, I probably wouldn't have. In fact, the doctor said to me, you can live a normal life, but you'll never be a musician. And I laughed and he said, what's so funny? I said, my record is number 76 on a Billboard Top 100 this week. He said, you can't possibly be a musician. It is physically impossible with your hearing. I said, well, nobody told me that. So I went ahead and did it anyway. Now, if I had better hearing, it would make my job as a musician a lot easier, but I can compose.
Right.
How can I compose the same way Beethoven did? I work with a keyboard, and I see the notes, and I know what they sound like.
Okay.
Hit this note, and hit that note, and I can work out what I want, what it to sound like, what the melody is,
mm-hmm.
by looking at the right hand on the keyboard. And then I form the chords that go with it. But it's all visual.
Yeah. But that's also partly discipline. You wanted to do it more and you, yeah, yeah, okay.
So you can overcome anything.
And it also helps though,
but
right?
But I knew what I wanted to do. It's like right. When I first started playing guitar, I wanted to play like Fats Domino, Ray Charles, and Little Richard. Now, we're talking about three players mm-hmm. who play piano.
Yeah.
But I was playing guitar.
Yeah.
So I play guitar like I would have played piano. My whole approach to rhythm and blues music, everything I played is based on what the piano would do. Like B.B. King would tell you what the way he plays his The single lines that he plays on the guitar are based on saxophone solos. He's hearing saxophone while playing guitar. Chuck Berry was listening to piano. And if you look at the what we call double stops, he's put two notes at a time. It's what a piano would normally do, playing thirds, sometimes fifths together. But he got it from listening to piano players. He just translated that to guitar.
All right. So that's also about being open, right? Open to everything.
Yeah. Rather than say that's not the way you play guitar, you don't play it like a piano. I didn't know any better. I wanted to play that New Orleans style of Pat's Domino, so I learned a way to do it.
You found a way.
As I said, that song Honky Tonk by Bill Doggett just got into my bloodstream, and I still go to sleep every night hearing it in my head. It's the bedrock of everything I do, that 1956 record, two parts. Maybe that's why I used to do my performances in two parts, two evenings. You got halfway through the song, you had to turn the record over.
God.
They weren't finished yet, but they ran out of space, so you had to turn it over to hear the rest of it.
Well, thank you for talking on so many different things.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Today's episode was recorded at AT1 Studio here in New York. I'm Eureka Foster. これからもどうぞよろしくお願いいたします。